Guardia.
Hi, everybody. I'm Otto. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm pleased to be here with you this evening. I want to tell you that my sobriety date is July 11th, 1985. And for that, I'm grateful. My home group is the Legacy Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is located in a suburb of Dallas called Plano, Texas. And if you're ever in that neck of the woods, please come see us. We've got the best group in the country. And if you don't feel that way about your group, you need to change. Oh, thank you for the basket and the invitation. And this is nice. This is really nice. I've been able to do this quite a few times, and trust me, everywhere we go is not this nice. This is kind of this kind of balances things out for all the little hole in the walls that we get invited to go to. But I'm grateful. This is cool. Okay, I'm going to try to get done in a reasonable amount of time. I am from On-Anon, and I used to get to speak 2-3 times a month all over the world. Then I started running over into the second CD, and they quit asking me to come talk. I don't know how that works. So my wife's enjoyed me being home more. But she retired last year, and I'm ready to go talk. Anyway, I had a problem with alcohol before I ever took my first drink. I grew up in an alcoholic home. Both my parents drank alcoholically, and it was a very violent and chaotic home. And so I learned things like, practice makes perfect, where there's a will, there's a way, if anyone can, you can, quitters never win, and winners never quit, exceptions are made for exceptional people, always give a man a good hand, always tell the truth, don't feel bad, and don't be afraid. And those are the tools I took out to go be a man. Little did I know, those were the things that were, some of the things that were killing me. I couldn't wait to get out of that house. My mom and dad married and divorced each other 3 times before I got out of high school. They couldn't live with each other. They couldn't live without each other. I'm the only member of my family of 6. I have 2 younger brothers, older sister. I'm the only member, including my parents, to ever graduate from high school, much less college. I'm the hero child I'm supposed to. My older sister was the primary enabler, and I was the hero child, so naturally I graduated from high school. I was a stud in high school. High school's kind of where I went to get away, and so I was class president and top teen and in student council and emceed the pep rallies and headed up the paper drives and played all the sports, didn't letter in any of them. It's hard to letter when your dad comes up and, you know, gets in fights with the coaches and shows up in the locker room drunk, you know, and gets his butt whipped by the coach. And it's just tough to stay with it, you know. And then my dad got whooped by one of the school tough kids, you know. God, Dad, you know, just stay in the car when you're at those red lights. Come on, Dad. And, of course, I swore I would never be like my father. How many of us did that? Yeah, it's a big club. Unfortunately, this is a family disease, and it runs in families, and myself, I'm not the only alcoholic child those my parents bore. Both my brothers are alcoholics, and my sister, who's not, married one. So, you know, and we're all married and divorced and married and divorced and married and divorced, and, you know, we don't have a family tree. We have more like a family thicket. You know, it's, Christmas is the holiday from hell at our house. Everybody's got multiple sets of grandparents and in-laws and outlaws, and, you know, it's the one time of the year we all get together, and that's the one time in the year that somebody in the family wants to resolve every issue that's happened in the last 40 years. And You know, there's a better chance that a squad car is going to show up at our house than Santa. People go to jail on Christmas at the house I grew up in. The best part of Christmas was my family is one that gives each other drugs and alcohol for gifts. So, I graduated from high school. My dad was really proud of me, and that didn't happen very often. I was glad to graduate from high school. I went off to Oklahoma State University and was excited about being an Oklahoma State Cowboy. Unfortunately, I'm not that bright. I'm just not that bright. I'm personable, but you know, there's a sign in my family's gene pool that says, no diving, okay? Don't go diving in there, you'll get hurt. And so I didn't do very well in college. And plus, you know, it might have had something to do with it, was that I was drinking a lot when I got away out from under my dad's thumb. Boy, I love to drink. And I joined a fraternity, and that fraternity loved to drink. And I might have known that I had a problem. I started having problems right away when I began to drink. I like to get naked when I drink. And it's not so much, you know, is Otto going to take his clothes off? You know, it's, when's he going to do it? Where's he going to be? You know, because I like to get on the roof or put the top down on the convertible, go speeding by, hanging onto the top of the windshield or something. And I think I'm a fun guy, you know. I just can't believe that other people aren't enjoying this as much as I am. And you have to know I was pretty bad because my fraternity made me a dry pledge. They said, Otto, you embarrass us. And you're not allowed to drink any longer until you become a member of this fraternity. Needless to say, I never got initiated into that fraternity because I like to drink. I didn't know that I was alcoholic. Never had a clue. Matter of fact, I had never tried to quit drinking before July 1985. Why would I quit? I think it'd be insane to quit drinking. I love to drink. I'm the kind of drinker that finds these novel. When the cap comes off, no need to put it back on. Well, I'm carrying too many hours. My family can't afford to send me to school, and I'm not making grades, so at the end of my freshman year, I was draft eligible. Hadn't even given that a thought. But in 1967, when I was finishing my freshman year in college, the Vietnam War was raging, and they needed some soldiers. And so they said, Otto. Bring it on in, boy, right here. Sell it dead, right there. So I became a member of the United States Army, and I thought, oh, man, this isn't what I want to do. But I thought, you know, this is more of my best thinking. I don't know about you guys. My best thinking sucks a lot, okay? But my best thinking was I'll go do 2 years in the Army, then I'll get out, come home, and then I'll go to school on the GI Bill, and I can go at my pace, and that's a good plan. I don't have to be hooked up with mom and dad, nothing. Well, I took this battery of tests when I went into the military. They give you a battery of tests to see what's a good MOS for you. That's what are you going to be? You know, are you going to be a medic, or are you going to be a grenadier, or, you know, general's aide? What are you going to be, you know? And I took the test, and I fully expected to be a general's aide, and or be in charge of the NCO club or motor pool or something cool, you know. But nope, they said, Otto, you're a rifleman. You get to be in the infantry, son. So I did my basic training, then I went on to advanced infantry training. And then it's time, I mean, it's like I've been in the Army 17 weeks and it's time to go to war. Time. Oh, this is not a good plan. And so I came up with another plan. And I decided that I would go to jump school and I would go to NCOCS. I wasn't sharp enough for OCS, but I wanted to be a helicopter pilot. No, sorry, Otto, can't do that. You're not sharp enough. We'll let you go to NCOCS. So I went to NCOCS, and I became what they call a Betty Crocker sergeant. I like being Sergeant Mers. I like being in charge. You guys like to be in charge? I'd much rather say, take that hill, than have somebody say, Otto, take the hill. No, I don't want you. Put me in charge, man. But, you know, I did everything I could do to avoid going to Vietnam. But after a year in service, I had a year left. And the war was still going on. I was kind of hoping they'd win it before I had to go. But turns out it was getting worse, you know. In 68, I went to Vietnam. And that was one of the worst years in Vietnam. That was the year of the Tet Offensive. And Americans were dying everywhere. And there was nothing that could have prepared me for the horrors of war. Vietnam was a very unique war in that it was a televised war. We learned a lot about what not to do in Vietnam. You know, you don't get to see the cameras rolling with the guys, going on patrol in Iraq because they don't want you to see what happens. But in Vietnam, it was a very unpopular war because they were showing all this stuff on TV. They were showing what we were doing to people and what was happening to us. And there were a lot of protests and people didn't like the war. I was talking to somebody earlier and was talking about, you know, even though I shouldn't, and I know this, I still sometimes have a feeling of some shame for having served in that conflict. I know that's inside me because I've been told thank you many times. But it was awful. I mean, growing up in the home I grew up in was awful. But nothing could make me ready for war. I'm not going to tell a lot of war stories, but I will say it's something that changed my life forever. Had a critical impact on my life was one particular assault we went in on. And we went on a really small LZ landing zone. And it was had just been blown out of the trees with artillery. We were fighting in the highlands and the jungles. And they blew this hole in the mountain so that we could get one helicopter in. So we were going in one helicopter at a time. We all had to jump out one side of the helicopter into these broken trees and things to get into the fight. And we weren't getting in fast enough. And we just went in with weapons and water. We didn't take any supplies or anything because we knew we were going to have contact with the enemy. And they were there, and they kicked our butts. And we hadn't gotten very many of us on the ground, and helicopter's letting the boys out, and here come a rocket out of the trees and hits that helicopter, and boom, down it goes. And it's burning on the LZ. We're trying to get these guys out of that helicopter, and we can't get them all out. It's rolled over, and listen to young men scream as they burn to death, and go back into the fight, you know. And it's kind of like where I grew up, you know. We just, when things would happen, when Dad would, I remember opening the bedroom door one time, seeing my dad on my mom's chest, pinning her to the bed with his knees and hitting her in the face with his fists and the blood everywhere and her screaming and him telling me to get back to my room. And I'd do that. And the next day, my brothers and sisters and I would get up and we'd walk around like nothing happened. You know, you don't say anything, you don't rock the boat. Just try to keep the peace, stay calm. And that's kind of the way it was in the war. We did this stuff, and we didn't talk about what we were doing. And we just did it. And the CO radioed down to the sergeant and says, we're going to drop some firefighting equipment into you and some plastic explosives. We need for you to knock down some trees. We wanted to get some help into you. And cool, we need help. So as I'm watching his helicopter, the command helicopter, it comes over the landing zone, and he's going to drop firefighting equipment to us and these explosives. And as I'm watching it to see where this stuff goes, here come another rocket. And down that helicopter wobbled, and it came and just fell into fire on top of the other one. And we were able to get all the guys out of that helicopter. But we had a lot of wounded and not very many guys on the ground. And we were in a really bad shape. One of the guys had been blown out of the door of that helicopter, the second one, and a kid named Henderson jumped and went into the jungle to look for this kid. Duh. I mean, that's real heroic, but I mean, that's it's the bad guys are out there. And at the time, the only one I had visual contact with was Henderson. And so when he jumped and ran, I jumped and ran too. And I'm decorated for heroism for following Henderson. Scared to death, you know. But I didn't know I was scared. Daddy told me I never was afraid. I was afraid and didn't know I was afraid. And we found this guy, and he was blown to pieces. His legs were blown off, and his face was destroyed, and pieces of his arms were mangled and gone. But he was still alive. And he's gurgling, and he's crying, and we're trying. We took our bootlaces, and we put tourniquets on each of his legs, high on his thighs, and took shirts and bandages and tried to stop the bleeding. He was bleeding from everywhere, and tried to muffle his cries so that he wouldn't draw fire. And pretty soon a medic came and took over, and me and Henderson went back into the fight. And I never saw that kid again. I never knew who he was. But I figured he probably died. He was so horribly injured. And I would have nightmares about that. You know, for years, my whole adult life, I'd have nightmares. I've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's real, folks. You know, when you have these intrusive dreams and things come to mind, it's more than an obsession. I mean, it's things you don't want to think about. And they come just say, let's talk. You know, you're not going to sleep. Let's think about this right here. Do you remember when? And the next day, I walked up on an enemy position, and I was shot twice. I was at close proximity, about from me to Steve, and I didn't see these guys, and they had an automatic weapon, and just a short burst of machine gun fire rang out, and one round hit me in my left hip, and the other round hit me in my left ankle. And if you've ever heard the expression, we're going to blow your ass off, that's what happened to me. It went in right here, and it came out next to my anus, and it took my gluteus maximus with it, and the top of my femur and my pelvis, and just blew it all away. And I spun to the ground, and I lost my helmet, and I lost my weapon, and I could hear these guys talking in their hole. And they got out of their hole, and they came and took my weapon and took my watch and went and got back in their hole. And you know, that was a really important moment in my life. Because what happened was, when I was shot, it takes a moment to realize what's happened. I mean, we weren't fighting at the time. I had just stumbled upon these guys. And so the shots that took me out were the first shots of this continuing conflict that day. And so I had to realize what happened to me. And what I realized is I've been shot. And my second thought was, God, help me. And my third conscious thought as I lay there was, there is no God. And September 22nd, 1968, I stopped wondering. I stopped being curious about the idea that there might be a God. You know, there had just been too much crap in my life. And I was no longer willing to consider the fact that there might be a loving God. If there's a God, where the hell has he been? You know, what's he doing? He must be a damn terrorist, is what I was feeling and thinking. And of course, a hell of a fight started after that, and I don't have time to tell you the stories, but I survived. And a really courageous young man named Dwayne Grindle crawled up under that gun and pulled me down after two others had been shot trying. And they dusted me off, and they sent me to a hospital in Yokota, Japan. I was there 7 weeks. And then they sent me to a hospital in California. And then they sent me to a hospital in Texas. And then they sent me to Reynolds Army Hospital in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, so I could be close to my family. They want me to have all that good family support. Don't you cry. I developed a gross staph infection. When I turned 21, I'd been in the hospital 4 months. When I turned 22, I was still laying there. I was hospitalized for 21 months before they released me, 1 year from the date I should have been discharged originally. I had an open draining wound in my buttocks for 7 years. Pus ran out onto my clothes, and I wore big bandages on my buttocks, and I walked on crutches, and I was angry. You know, all my buddies had gone on and graduated from college, and here I am crippled up and not supposed to walk, and my left leg's 4 inches shorter than my right, and I don't have a lot of feeling in it, and I don't have any muscles, and I wasn't happy about it. But I did get a college degree in something I didn't want a degree in. This is what the counselor said I should do, and so I had aspirations of being an architect. Wasn't going to happen. But they did get me to be an accountant. And, you know, for a stud like me, that's just not the vocation I was looking for. I married my high school sweetheart. I married her quick because I didn't want her to get away. You know, she might change her mind if she gets a good look at my wounds. Matter of fact, we got married in the hospital at Reynolds Army Hospital in Fort Sill. She was a senior in high school. And against her parents' wishes, she came down with two of my good friends. And the chaplain came into the room. I was wearing a spica or a body cast at the time. This is plaster from the chest down. My whole body's encased in plaster. Well, they'd leave a little hole down there, but they gave me a new one for the wedding. It was a lot of fun. They molded a little saddle on it. You know, it was great. My buddy showed up, and the chaplain came in. He married us there in the hospital room. And then my two buddies and my new bride, my bedpan and my urinal, we all got in this pickup truck or station wagon. And they just, you know, they took me down on the gurney and just sit me in the back of the wagon and on a mattress. And away to the Holiday Inn we went. And, I took advantage of a lot of chicken, a lot of beer, a lot of pain medication. Consummated that wedding, and the next day she went home to mom and dad, and I went back to the hospital. And you know, I was always afraid I wasn't going to get what I wanted. I don't know about you guys, I've always been afraid to let go. You know, I'm so afraid to let my dad be in charge. You know, I'm so afraid to let it's, I mean, no matter what I try to do, it seems like other people screw it up. I have been a victim my whole Don't you laugh, it's true. I'm a person who was an excuse drinker. I got lots of excuses for drinking. If you had my problems, you'd drink too. They couldn't get my hip to fuse. They were just trying to get it to fuse into a ball, just a wad, so that I'd have this crutch to walk on. But it didn't fuse it. I got what they call a fibrous union, which means just the soft tissue was holding my leg together, and so the bones would move on each other about 5 degrees, and it was bone-on-bone motion, and it was horribly painful, and I lived with that every day, and you don't understand. Don't begrudge me my drink. Don't begrudge me my medication. I like to wear 501 blue jeans, I carry my little pills in that watch pocket right there. All day long. What you got? Tic Tac. Can I have one? Oh, all out. But I felt quite justified in every drink I ever took. You see, I need to get drunk so I can go to sleep. I can't sleep at night. When I lay down to go to sleep, I see my dad on my mom's chest. When I lay down to go to sleep at night, I see my brother twisting on a t-shirt in the jail cell where he hanged himself. When I go to sleep at night, I see my buddies blown to pieces in Vietnam. When I go to sleep, I remember laying in that hospital all those many, many, many months and all the pain. I was just a really pathetic case of poor me, poor me, pour me another drink. And, I could go to a tavern or a bar and people would buy me drinks because it's such a sad story. It is so sad. just living on a little pension. You know, anyway, I'm having trouble getting to work. They helped me get a good job. But if you drink like I drink, it's hard to show up for work in the morning. And so my employer changed my job so that I didn't have to be there till noon. Because I was pretty good when I was there, and they all like me. I'm a real personable guy. And but, you know, I got to where I couldn't get there at noon. I like to drink. And I can remember laying in my recliner, you know, watching TV late, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, drinking and eating pills and complaining about what's on TV. There weren't 150 channels back in 1984, I'll tell you that. I just saw that crap 5 minutes ago, and you're just mad as hell, and I need to get up and go pee, but I'm too drunk to get up and go pee. And drinking out of a big, that would not work. I'd be drinking out of a big tumbler. I'd be drinking out of this. This is how I like, y'all thirsty? I hope you got enough there. That's how I like to drink. Don't care about other people. Don't care about other people. I find myself, before my drink is gone, and I like to drink bourbon, a whole lot of bourbon, a little bit of Coke. Find myself, before my drink is gone, in the kitchen fixing myself another drink that I don't want, and then go back and get in my chair and not have peed. Now, I think that says something to being about, you know, maybe being an alcoholic. But I had never heard of AA. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. My parents certainly never mentioned it. They never got sober. I'm the only member of my family to get sober. So I had no clue. I thought alcoholics were like W.C. Fields, you know, or Skid Row bums or winos. Those were the ideas I had of alcoholics. They weren't studs like me. You know, they weren't disabled combat veterans with medals for valor for chasing Henderson out there. And I was really pissed they didn't give me the Silver Star. I really was. Of course, I'm the kind of alcoholic they can be introducing somebody with all this flowery stuff. I remember I was in one of my early meetings in there introducing some guy, and it wasn't just call on this guy. They were giving him this big, grandiose introduction. And, you know, I hadn't done any of the things they were saying, but I just knew they were going to call on me. I am selfish and self-centered to the max. Matter of fact, that's the root of my problem. Anyway, I wound up in a hospital. I didn't go there because I thought I had a drinking problem. I went there because I knew I had a prescription drug problem. I was taking Valium, and there was a lot of stuff on television about Valium being overprescribed and abused. And that, you know, I was always out of Valium. And once you get addicted to Valium and then you run out, it really sucks to be... out of Valium, you know? I mean, I'd really rather have a Valium. I was a dock worker, and that doesn't have anything to do with ships like you all have here. That just means Dr. A don't know what Dr. B's giving me. Dr. B don't know what Dr. C's giving me. Dr. C don't know what Dr. D's giving me. And I was a hell of a dock worker. I didn't have to go very far. You know, they didn't have computers back then to catch us. I feel sorry for you guys now that are trying to squander those, you know, get those damn things without having to come up with a script. You know, there were the good old days when you could just go into somebody's house and rifle. I'd always ask them, have you got a toothpick? Oh, they're in the cabinet. I'll get them. And then you rifle through their cabinets, you know, and you find the old bottle of Percocet. You know, it's dated 8 months ago, prescription for 30. There's 28 in there. They obviously don't need them. Those are mine. And I could go to any clinic or anywhere, and, you know, I'd just travel a few miles out of town to one place I hadn't been to yet, and I'd just go in there, and, oh, it's terrible. I'd drop my pants, and they'd go, oh, shit. Yeah. What do you need? You know, this. Anything I wanted. And plus, the VA sends me pills in the mail. This was really the cool part. You know, sometimes you just have to stagger out to the mailbox, you know, because I've come to a point where I'm unemployed and unemployable. Just go get your pills and go back in the house and sit down. I stopped being personable and social. I didn't have a dog. I'm divorced again. And life was pretty miserable. And I thought, if I can get off this Valium, I'll do better. You know, if I can get off the Valium and get on something else that's not so addictive. And that's truly the plan. I went to treatment at St. Anthony's Hospital fully expecting just to get a detox and get on some other drug. I was really dumb. And something wonderful happened there. You know, they were going to treat my alcoholism, and even though I didn't know I had it. And they gave us this education about alcoholism's a disease. You know, you're not a bad person, you're a sick person. And fortunately, it's a treatable disease. Unfortunately, if you've got this disease, it's the only one that tells you you don't have it. And, you know, I'm just drooling in the corner. I went to treatment on July 1st, and my sobriety date's July 11th because, you know, they give us detox. I needed a medical detox, but I was feeling pretty good on about day 9. And starting to get it together, and I'm starting to hear what they're saying. But I had one more day of prescription, and those pills are down at the nurse's station with my name on them. I don't need them. Otto. So I had to go get it. And I knew I didn't need it, and that's, I had to sit down and had a long talk with my counselor that day, and that's the day that I called my sobriety date, because I took that pill when I didn't need it. But the real gift I got in treatment wasn't any of the teaching they did or anything, it was the fact that you guys came in and visited us. You know, y'all were doing 12-step work, coming into the hospital, sometimes individually, sometimes you'd bring a meeting into the hospital, and you guys were the most interesting bunch of characters I ever saw in my life. Now, all these people I'm in treatment with, they are all sick. I can't even believe that they would put me in a ward with all these sick bastards. You know, I mean, I'm in there with blacks and drug addicts. Oh, my God. Women. Oh, no. Sick babies. I should have been in some place where they had horseback riding or something. You know, I don't know. Anyway, you guys were amazing, and you guys would talk about yourself, and this is what's so great about AA, is that for a long time, people had been trying to help me, wonderful people, good people had tried to help me. They say, Otto, you drink too much. Otto, you take too much medication. And I would tell them, it's just straight out, and it's not a lie. No, I don't. No, I don't. And that wasn't a lie, you know. They talk about denial. It doesn't mention denial in our book. Our book talks about delusion. And I was truly delusional, you know, because any reasonable person could put two and two together and see that maybe alcohol was causing me a problem. But I could always rationalize, justify, minimize, explain away the consequences of my drinking such that it is not the drinking. I remember one of my last debacles. Yeah, I finally got to use that word. I thought that was always... That's first. I'm a car racing fan, and I went to Daytona Speed Weeks. Now, I'm out of friends by this time. This is about 6 months where I wound up in treatment. So I go by myself. And, of course, I hook up with some good old boys down there. And if you're like me, that means they got a big cooler full of beer. I never hook up with the family with the little playmate cooler. You know, I get a big cooler of beer. So I'm sitting with these good old boys who enjoy racing like I do, and we're going all over Central Florida to the car races, Speed Weeks, and we're at the Tampa Fairgrounds watching the late models go in circles on the dirt and drinking that cold beer. So it was a good show. Watched and enjoyed the races very much. So we came out, and the fair is going on. Florida State Fair is going on. So we walked around the fairgrounds and threw balls at Cupid dolls ate corny dogs and scoped out the girls. Girl watching's a big, big, I really enjoy girl watching's really good here, too. It's really good. Okay. Got to give you a big thumbs up, SoCal. Okay. And then we leave the fair and we go to a nightclub. And I'll never forget this place. It was called The Pit. Now, that doesn't mean it was a dive. It was a nice club, but they had this big hole in the ground inside this club, and that's where you danced. You go down into the pit to dance. And I love to dance. Now, I might be crippled. But I love to dance. Dancing is fun. I got my fake gold jewelry and my fake alligator boots, and I'm trolling for you little Al-Anons, you know. I'm kind of like those guys on Saturday Night Live, you know. That's me. Well, I don't know if you've ever done this or not, but I've been drinking bourbon since I got to the club, and I've probably been drinking 12, 14 hours. And I get sick. You know, that's happened to me a lot. I would get sick. I stagger out into the parking lot, and I'm holding onto the cars so I don't fall down. Just blowing out of my face. It's on these poor people's car. It's on my pants. It's on my boots. Oh, God. Oh. I got little pieces of corn dog stuck up in my nose. Go back in the club. Get me another drink. Gotta wash that taste out of my mouth. Oh. Tell that little gal I've got cornered. The one with the big sore on her lip right here. I will never, ever, ever, as long as I live, ever eat another state fair corn dog. That greasy damn thing made me sick. And that was as true as 2 and 2 is 4, and that's up and that's down, and my blue jeans are blue, and that corn dog made me sick. Because you see, I drink just fine, thank you. I love to drink. I enjoy drinking. I can drink a lot. I drink all the time. Drinking don't bother me a bit. Don't know what I'd do if I couldn't drink. My life's painful. And when you guys came in and you started to share your stories, you didn't say, Otto, you drink too much. Otto, you take too much medication. You said, Otto, I drank too much. And I took too much medication. And I'd go to the club and I'd get sick and go in the parking lot and throw up. And people would try to tell me I drink too much, but I couldn't believe them. And I'm sitting there listening to you guys tell these stories about yourself, and I'm going, don't tell that one. God, I can't believe he said that. Oh, gosh, I wouldn't have told anybody that. And you guys were amazing. And it was like somebody had been telling a joke my whole life and I didn't get it. And then all of a sudden I got it. You know, if you're alcoholics, I must be alcoholic too. And you know what? I bet my mom and dad are... Holy cow, this is what's been wrong. I was so excited. You know, I had done everything I knew to wrestle some kind of happiness out of my life, and I couldn't do it. I changed hobbies, houses, cars, wives, jobs, locations, music, hairstyles. I did everything I knew to try to change things so that I could get happy. I'm really trying hard. I'm a good guy. I'm a good guy. I can't get happy. I don't know what it is. Get rid of the bitch. Get you another one. And it had to be her fault because I'm trying hard, you know. And I was excited to find out that I was alcoholic. to finally have this revelationary moment. I'm alcoholic. Oh, Mom, Dad, we're all alcoholics. Come on. They weren't as excited about it as I was. I became the weirdo in the family, you know. And of course, I'm an overachiever and a perfectionist. So when I decided to get sober, I'm going to be the best sober person ever. You know, I'm going to do everything they told me to do. They said, you know, you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Okay, I can do that. You need to get you a big book and read it. It's not a novel. It's not light reading. It's a text. You need to read it and study it, okay? You need to get you a sponsor, a mentor, someone who can guide you through the steps, who can help answer questions you don't know the answers to in your early sobriety. I can do that. You need to not drink one day at a time. What about the pills? What about the pills? No pills, Otto. No pills. Oh. No pills. Oh shit! No pills. Okay, we want you to take these 12 steps. I had this big thing on the wall. Y'all don't have them here tonight. You got this wonderful banner, no steps. It's funny, the elevator was broken when we went to dinner tonight. Take the steps. I'm going to be a good little alcoholic, and it doesn't take me long to read down there. God. God, damn. It's a God deal. I am furious. I cannot believe it. It's a God deal. I've been hoodwinked. I've been duped. I should have went to Schick. I should have went to the VA. I should have went anywhere but St. Anthony's Catholic Hospital. Jesus Christ, you go in for a churchy hospital and you're going to get a churchy solution. I am such a loser. I want it out. Turn me out. I do not believe in God. Let me go. Let my people go. And they said, you can go, Otto, but it will be against medical advice. We advise you to stay here. And if you leave AMA, your insurance is not going to pay for this. And we will expect you to. Did you ever get indignant? I ain't paying for this. So I stayed. Didn't have anywhere else to go. But I was furious. I mean, I was really upset. And a guy named Mike, who's coming up and he's doing 12-step work, really cool guy. You know, he hadn't been sober very long, and you don't have to be sober very long to carry this message. You know, if you haven't drank for a couple of days, you can help the guy that has. You know, just try to help. And Mike came up to the hospital, and I don't know, he had 8 or 9 months sobriety, and he's just doing 12-step work, and he sits down with me, and he says, Otto, what's the deal with you and God? And, oh, boy. Boom, I let him know. If there's a God, you know, boom, boom, why the earthquakes? Why the floods? Why the tornadoes? Why the hurricanes? Why the Holocaust? You know, why the war? Why my mom? Why my dad? You know, my little brother Jack had colonitis, very rare in a young person. The chaos in the family where I grew up was so strict that my brothers had ulcer all through his intestines. They had to take his intestines out. He craps out of a hole in his side into a bag, you know, and so he goes to prison and he hangs himself. And my other little brother's been in prison 3 times. And, you know, I told him the story about what happened to me the day I was shot. And he said something to me that changed everything. I know today, in hindsight, that my higher power gave him these words to gift me with. And he said, Otto, you don't have to believe in the God you gave up on in Vietnam. And with that sentence, he let me out of the corner I had painted myself into. You know, I had seen a lot of wonderful spiritual people a lot of wonderful church people that I admired that I came to meet during the course of my careers and marriages. And and I always thought it was really cool what they had, but, you know, I was no way. And but Mike let me out of that corner with that little sentence, and what a gift he gave me. You know, he said, you know, it's God as we understood him. What would God have to be for you to take a chance and try and turn your will and your life over to his care? Just try. You get to keep control. Just to allow him to care for you. You know, I don't know about this. I always thought I was supposed to figure out what God wanted me to do. You know, and then I'm supposed to get on this straight and narrow, and if I can do what God would have me do, then I'll be good enough to be graced. And I have not been good. And so I deserve no grace. And he says, no. He says, not what do you have to be. He says, what would God have to be? Now, I thought this was ridiculous. I'm going to define God. I like it. Okay. I can do that job. Yeah. So I came up with a real simple concept that God's all-powerful. He can do anything. He's omnipotent. And with all his power, all he wants is for me to stay sober, because I truly believe I am alcoholic, is for me to stay sober. And here's the hook. I have to like it. He'll keep me sober and have me like it. And so the next time Mike came to the hospital, I showed that to him, fully expecting him to say, no, Otto, no Disneyland gods. Come on, buddy, pick a team. Pick a team. What are you going to be, Hindu, Muslim, Catholic, Christian? Come on, pick a team. Don't pick the wrong team. We're killing each other all over the world. Come on, buddy. You want to ching around the airports in a little yellow gown? What are you going to be, huh? What are you going to be? That's not what he said. He says, that's your higher power. You pray to that higher power, a God that's omnipotent, and with all his power, all he wishes is for you to stay sober and like it. Now, I did not think for 1 minute that this would work. No way is this going to work. And I'm a guy who always has ulterior motives. You know, I go to my early AA meetings, and they say, if you want what we got, keep coming back. And I'm looking out here at some of these pretty girls and going, I'd like to have some of that. So I will come back. You know, my motives were never pure. And so what I decided on this, doing all these five things they've asked me to do and praying to this God that I really don't believe in, but that I'm willing to give a shot, is I decided to document it all. And so while everybody else is making moccasins and salt candles, salt landscapes, where you take the salt and you rub it on the chalk and then you pour it in a little glass and you mix the landscapes, I'm making calendars and documents. And I've got this. I'm documenting all my meetings. I'm documenting what time I called my sponsor and what time we talk about it. And I'm having guys that I was in treatment with come to my house, and we would read aloud together every day. They just thought it was really cool. We had a really high incidence of recovery in this group too. Y'all see me pray. We're praying at the meetings, right? I'm keeping track of all my meetings. We're holding hands. We're praying. So I got it all done. I'm doing everything they said to do. Because when I get drunk, I'm going to sue Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was my motivation. And my early sobriety was to do everything you asked me to do and do it because I'm going to own all of this. Anyway, I had decided that I was really going to pray. I was going to, you know, give it a real shot. I mean, I wanted to be sober. I can't imagine how else I'm going to be sober. You guys seem to be so happy in your sobriety. I mean, that was just the amazing part. You guys had all these horrid stories. You know, one guy came in, he tried to kill himself. His life was so unmanageable, he turned on the gas stove and he just blew up his house. You know, and he was burned horribly. You know, he didn't have any fingers. He just had stumps, you know, in his skin. He's all deformed. And he, you know, I couldn't use my ace in the hole. You know, oh, I got this disability. It's really painful, you know. This guy, I mean, he's screwed up. And he was happy, you know. And wow. So I decided I was going to pray, but I don't know how to pray. And I was in a room with two other guys, and I didn't want them to see me pray. I'm a little bit proud. And So I had a dilemma. This is why you need a sponsor. Any of you that are new, this is why you need a sponsor, so you can answer these kind of questions. I was wondering, should I pleasure myself and pray, or pray and pleasure myself? I pleasure myself every night, sometimes every day, sometimes two or three times. I couldn't make an exception this night that I'm going to say my first prayer. What do you do? You know, I'm afraid that if he is, he won't let me. But if I do, might piss him off. What'd you do?
Pissed him off.
Pissed him off. I did too. Not taking any chances, but I was very relaxed when I was going to say my first prayer. And I remember my first prayer went just like this. I remember it very well. God help me. I wonder what Pat's doing. I'll bet there's a pickup truck in her driveway right now. I'll bet there's some cowboy in there with that. I'll kill that bitch. And that, you know, that's my first prayer. I'm like a balloon, you know. You just blow it up and let it go. But fortunately, God doesn't make too hard of terms for those that seek him. And God help me, I wonder what Pat's doing was good enough for me to make a beginning. And I did those things that for all the wrong reasons. And what happened is I stayed sober 30 days and 60 days and 90 days and 120 days. And I started to enjoy you. And you guys welcomed me and loved me when I wasn't lovable. And you took me places that I didn't think I deserved to get to go. And I was so honored to come to your homes and to go out and eat a hamburger with you guys. I mean, you guys were amazing to me. I wanted so desperately what you had. And, my sponsor explained to me that we take the steps not to get sober, but to have a spiritual awakening. 12 steps says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result, not a result, one of many, it's the desired result, a spiritual awakening. Having had that spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, we can begin to practice those principles and live a different kind of life, help others. You know, and it is so gorgeous today. I mean, it's incredible that I can take the tragedy of my past and turn it into my greatest assets today. I can come up here and help people. And I sponsor individuals. And I can take the crap that's in my past and say, there's hope. You know, if you live with chronic pain, if you're a veteran, and those of you who have families that are serving now or have families who have served, thank you for your sacrifice and your service. I can help. I can help. I get calls from veterans all over the United States calling me. It's wonderful. It makes me feel useful. It makes me feel purposeful. It makes me feel loved. I know today that there is no doubt in my mind there is a God. I took these 12 steps, and I have had a spiritual awakening. I learned in my fourth step all the stuff my parents didn't teach me. But they should have. Normal people learn this stuff from their parents. I didn't learn it. I didn't know that my problems were of my own making and that when I'm afraid, I need to just be a little more courageous and not pretend like I'm not afraid, that I need to match fear with faith. I didn't know these things. You know, I came to find out that all of my problems are of my own making. Damn. Go figure. There's one part about my fourth step, though. I told my sponsor, I said, I'll do anything except go back to Vietnam. I'm not going back to Vietnam. I will not relive that. And I thought I'd get out of doing a four-step, but he said, well, you do what you can, and God will take care of that in his own time. So I did the four-step, and the four-step and the fifth-step were incredible experiences for me. I mean, it's so simple to find out that, you know, if everybody has to change for me to get happy, I'm screwed. It's just not going to happen. You know, if life has to change for me to get happy, I am screwed. So what is it about me that needs to change? And I found out that I'm intolerant, I'm impatient, I'm demanding, I'm controlling, I'm unrealistic, I'm punishing. I've got all these all these character defects that, you know, if resolved, then I can become a more enjoyable person living a more enjoyable life. And that's exactly what has happened. I made my amends and I cleaned up the wreckage of my past, and I found out that the world's not as mean and nasty as I thought it was. You know, most of the people I made amends to, with one exception, everybody was happy for me. Everybody was glad to have me making amends to them. Everybody was pleased to know that I was getting better and that I wasn't drinking and drugging anymore. They were excited. And I never thought that, if you'd have come to me and said that you'd quit drinking and you wanted to make amends for something you'd done, I'd get a hold of you. You know, I'd get everything I could get out of it. And people aren't like me. People aren't like the family where I come from. People are really kind and generous, you know, and I don't have to be afraid anymore. And it's a wonderful world that I live in today. Today I'm married to the woman I was dating when I went to Florida. She's a sicko. She's picking me out of the lot, you know. But she came to treatment as my significant other, and she's attended Al-Anon now for 23 years, and we've been married for 21, coming up on 22, and I love her like I never loved anyone. She's my best friend. We enjoy each other so much. She was supposed to come this weekend, and it's just been a real hard weekend because I want her here so much, you know, and she cries when I talk to her because she wants to be here and she can't. And I love my wife, and I wish you could meet her. She is awesome. But my whole life has changed. I'm happier, healthier, more whole physically, emotionally, socially, legally, financially, maritally, parentally. Every aspect of my life has been made better. I stayed drunk too long, so I can't tell you about all these wonderful things that have happened in my life. I will say that there's a long version of the Serenity Prayer. There's more to it than what we say in the meetings, and it says that God will make everything right if we'll simply completely give ourselves to Him. And that has been made absolutely true in my life. Everything has been made right. Everything. I am at peace with everything. I have my family back. When I buried my dad, he never got sober. He was an ass till the day he died. He was a vulgar, nasty man. He was barred from drinking in Oklahoma City. He had to go out of town to the little taverns, out of town in the country to drink. And when I buried my father, I buried a loved one, not a lovable one. And I learned how to do that in here. The first guy I ever sponsored, I fell in love with him. I wanted so much for him to get what I had gotten. And I found out for the first time in my life what altruism was, to do for someone else expecting nothing in return. Then Paul O. came and spoke at our anniversary, and he talked about loving Max no matter what. You know, making Max happy no matter what. She wants a steel sink when they got a perfectly good porcelain sink. I'll get her the steel sink. And I'm going, whoa. You know, I lived with a set of scales. You know, I'm keeping score. You know, I put a little on. You got to put a little on. You don't put a little on, I'm pissed, okay? And, this just do nothing. You know, I didn't know how to do nothing, expecting nothing in return until I met a bunch of drunks that didn't have anything to give me. You know, I always get the guy that wants me to help him is always the guy that needs me to take him to the laundromat, you know, to help him. He needs a quarter to get his laundry done. And we sit outside and he burns himself with cigarettes while we talk, you know, and other guys are getting guys driving Lincolns and shit to be their sponsor, or sponsorees, but I got exactly what I needed, and I fell in love with these guys, and some of these guys I have sponsored now for over 20 years, and it's amazing how many people have gotten sober. And anyway, everything has been made right. I'm good. And just tell a couple stories. I know it's been long, but hopefully this is worth it. I've been sober a couple years. My first wife comes to me and she says, "You're doing so good. You take the little bitch before I kill her." So my daughter comes to live with me. She's 14, and she's a little bitch. She comes by it honestly. I used to take her home for Christmas every year. You know, I'd be taking her to school or something, and she'd say something to me, and I just want to reach over and pull the lips off of her face. But I told her when she came to live with me. She didn't want to come. She was coming from a nice house out in the nice part of town with the Duniburg purses and the Guess jeans and the hot tub. And I'm living inner city with no furniture and no mat. I'm sleeping on a mattress on the floor. And her mom had all she could stand, so she gave her to me. They had to cut the canopy off her bed to get it in this little bedroom I had for her. You know, she's pissed. And I'm not doing real good with it, you know, because she's acting out. She won't clean up her mess. She won't take her dishes in. You know, she wants to eat in her room, and she won't take the dishes to the kitchen, and she won't help with the laundry. She won't do anything. She's just angry. And I call my sponsor and say, "Johnny, I'm going to kill this little bitch." He says, "No, no." And I tell you, folks, early in my sobriety, I started going to Al-Anon. This is the truth. It says in the 8th step in the 12 and 12 that defective relationships are the cause of most all our problems. And I got a lot of help with my relationships in AA. But I got a whole lot more help with my relationships in Al-Anon. So if you've been sober for a while and you're not really enjoying your relationships, if you're not being successful in relationships, I invite you to come and join us in Al-Anon. We'll be happy to have you. So I'd go to Al-Anon, and I'd get calmed down, and I'd be able to go home and not kill the little girl. My sponsor says thing. I says, "Johnny, her room stinks." He says, she's a pig. She lives like a pig. He says, "She's not a pig, Otto. She's a frightened little girl. Why don't you just close the door? And you don't have to say anything." Oh, it was so hard to let go, give up control, be right. It was so hard to stop. But you know what? After a while, when she got tired of living in the stink and the filth and being alone, she cleaned it up. When she was ready, she cleaned it up. You know what? I made good on my promise to her to love her no matter what. I still sign my cards and letters to her today. Love you no matter what. Because that was the promise I made to her. It was the same promise you all made to me when I came to AA. I'll love you no matter what. And we grew closer. Things got better. We're doing pretty good. She turned 16. I'm tired of driving her little ass around, so I bought her this cheap car. My motives are still selfish. I've only been sober a little while. So I bought her a car that I thought she couldn't get hurt in. It was a little 82 Honda Prelude. You know, you step on the gas, it just makes more noise. It doesn't go faster. You know, the tack moves and that's it. And I figured she can't get hurt in that, you know. Not much of a car, but she's not much of a driver either. So she's a curb banger. Loves to bang curbs. She just can't see. She just can't figure out where that, you know. That. So anyway, we're doing really good. And I have this really cool little sports car that I've had painted and got a new top on it and a big kicker stereo, you know, one of those. You know, when the little kids pull up next to you and the 17-year-olds and they got the. That's me at 37, 40, yeah. So she comes to me one night, she says, "Dad, can Kristen and I take the convertible? I'm a car guy, you know. I'm the kind of guy, you all have these at your club, or at your group, the guy that drives the really nice car. Hadn't got dick for recovery, but he drives a really nice car. And he parks it right in front of the club door. He'll park it illegally so that you can see what he's driving. That's kind of how I was about cars. So I put the top down. I said, "Okay, sweetheart, be careful. Be careful. Be careful. It's my car." She's doing so good. She wasn't gone 30 minutes. Ring! "Dad, I was going too fast and I crashed the car." "Are you okay?" "Kristen okay? Where you at?" "Where they're not supposed to be." "Stay right there, sweetheart. Stay right there. I'll be right there." I hung that phone up. Screw this, love you no matter what. All bets are off. Anything but my car, the little bitch is dead. And I'm in that little 82 Prelude. Going to get her, and it will not get me there fast enough. I'm about to pull the wheel off of this car. And I got that conversation going on in my head, you know, where she's going to say, and then I'm going to say, and when she says, then I'm going to say. And I actually hear her say, "Dad, I was going too fast and I crashed the car." Well, that's a first. That's the first ever in my whole lineage, I think. She copped to it. I told my dad, "Dad, a deer ran out from me and I swerved to miss it." Wasn't the truth. I was just going too fast. And he beat me damn near to death. I remember he picked me up by my ears and hit me. "Didn't I tell you to be careful? Don't you know what that car means to this family? Don't you know what that's going to do to insurance?" And he beat me. And that night, I was able to go to Holly and comfort her. See, I don't have to tell her those things because she knows. She's dying. The one person in the world she most wishes to please is me. And she's trashed my car. And she knows what it's going to do to insurance. And she knows what that car means to me. Whew, isn't that a great time, Dad, to come whip your ass, you know, when you're really hurting? That's how crazy it was where I grew up. And because of this program, you know, that insanity's changed in my life. I have different relationships with all my family and with all my friends today. Just finished building the coolest tree house in my daughter's tree. It's awesome. It's going to be a one weekend, couple hundred dollar project. I know the first time she has sex, it will be in this tree house. It's an awesome tree house. Anyway, nothing, absolutely nothing is too big for God to take care of. My God, the God of my understanding. I was at the car races where I go every Friday night. I'm a race nut. And I was at the car races in Oklahoma City, and beautiful night, good car count, fast track. Friends are there having a good time like we always do. We gamble a few dollars on the races. And some of my buddies are sober and they're race fans, and we're out there. And for a reason unknown to me, I decide to go home. And I get up and I tell everybody I'm going home. And they say, "What are you doing? Where are you going?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know. I just have to go home." And I was really sad as I left the grandstand. Huge grandstand. I'm walking down the ramps. And I'm going home in the middle of my passion, which is racing. I walk in the house and Pat, my wife, she's shocked to see me. "What are you doing here?" I said, "I don't know." Sat down, 9 o'clock, Friday night, turned on the television. 2020 was coming on. Back then it was Hugh Downs and Barbara Walters. 2020. This is 2020. And they used to do three little vignettes each week. And the first vignette that came on, the first little short story, was called "The Gift of Life." And it shows a picture of a helicopter flying over the jungles of Vietnam. And it's about an author who's, I can't think of his name right now, but he's writing a book on emergency room trauma. And he's talking and interviewing the top trauma specialists throughout the country, and he interviews one Dr. Kenneth Swan. And he asked Dr. Swan, "What is the worst trauma case you ever attended to?" And Dr. Swan began to recount when he was a young surgeon at the 71st Medevac in Pleiku, Vietnam. And on September 21st, 1968, they brought in a soldier who was so gravely wounded, the consensus was to medicate him, set him aside, declare him expectant, and let him die. His legs are blown off. He's got shrapnel the size of your thumb in the middle of his brain. He has no eyes. His arms are mangled. His left arm's detached at the shoulder. Fingers missing. Let him die. And Dr. Swan went against the consensus and operated on this kid and saved his life. And so the young man writing the book says, How'd he turn out? And Dr. Swan didn't know. He had never followed up. He hadn't even thought about him until that question was asked. And so it took him 2 years to find him. And, for the guy, he says, this is just a story for me. For you, it's going to be coming face to face with the truth of the decision you made that day to save this kid. And so they began to tell his story, and his story is my story. He was in a helicopter trying to drop equipment to an infantryman pinned down in the jungle, and I'm just sitting on the sofa shaking, just shaking. My wife came over, and she hangs on to me. She says, what's going on? I said, I think this is my kid. This is my nightmare. This is my story that I've told you. This is, and it was. His name's Ken McGarity. He lives in Columbus, Georgia. He has no legs. Not even stumps. He sits on his tailbone. His left arm's been reattached backwards at the shoulder. It sits behind him, and his front arm sits in front of him like this so he can sit like Humpty Dumpty. He has no eyes in his head. He's blind. He's legless. He can feel with two fingers. But he's married and has fathered two children. He's very gregarious and outgoing. He sails. And he scuba dives. But the guy suffers horribly with PTSD. And he abuses his wife. He's violent. He sleeps with guns. He still talks Didi Mao. And he can't get home. He's one of these guys that has yet to come home from Vietnam. And as they talked and the doctor went to visit with him and they gave him the medals that he never received, he was asking, I just don't know what happened to me that day. What happened to me that day? And Dr. Swan couldn't tell him anything more than what happened at the hospital, but I could. And so I reached out to Kenny, and he had an unlisted number, so I called the doctor, and the doctor called me, and I told him who I thought I was, and he said he'd give that number to Kenny, and if Kenny wanted to call me, he could. And Kenny called me a couple of days later and started asking me lots of questions that I couldn't answer. He wore a special kind of helmet. What did my helmet look like? You didn't have a helmet. Your head's blown to pieces. I don't know. And I said, but I was decorated that day by the commander of your helicopter. And he says, well, give me the name. And I had that citation, and I went and looked at it and came back, and I said, it's Colonel John Yarbrough. He said, that's the commander of my helicopter. And that started a conversation between Kenny and I. And I'm trying to help Kenny get home, and it was time for me to do that inventory on Vietnam. Because Kenny drugged me back into those jungles, and he took me to all those places and all those names and all those memories that I did not want to remember. And it was hard. But he heard my program. He heard this program. He heard our program. And I'm running long, so I'm going to tell you, Kenny got sober. Absolutely amazing. I spoke at the Georgia State Kent Convention many years ago, and Kenny was in the audience. And when I said he got sober, I said, how long have you been sober, Kenny? And out of the audience came, about 10 years. He's a hell of a guy. But I was pissed. They were making a movie about him and the doctor. HBO's doing a movie. Who's going to play me, I wonder? Turns out, nobody. I'm pissed. And so anyway, I'm trying to pretend like I'm not, but I'm angry. And so he's asked me to send him some memorabilia for his movie. And I put a cover letter on it. And his cover letter I wrote, Kenny, I've got a resentment. He's sober. He understands what a resentment is. And I said, you've never told me thank you for saving your life. It was no small damn feat. I mean, I ran into a burning jungle with the enemy shooting at us and took care of your ass, and you've yet to say thank you. I showed it to my wife. She says, what is that? She said, isn't there something in your book about, if there's a bug up your ass, it's your bug or something? If somebody bothers you, it's you. So I went to edit it out. I'm just going to edit it out. I don't want to rewrite this whole damn letter. I'm just going to edit it out. And so what came out was God's gift to me. What came out was freedom for me, because what came out as I tried to change that letter was, Kenny, I've never said thank you. Whoa. I'm so selfish and self-centered, self-absorbed and biased in my perspective that I can only see me running to help Kenny. Another truth, Kenny's safe in a helicopter. I'm pinned down in a burning jungle. Kenny flies into harm's way to save me. And when that rocket hit that helicopter, he gave his sight and he gave his legs and he entered into that darkness and that disability for me. Selfish, self-centered, that's the root of my problem. I tell you, all my problems are of my own making. I live in a wonderful, wonderful world. God is in his heaven. All is right on earth. Everything's fine, Otto. I don't have nightmares anymore. I still get paid. They say I'm still screwed up, so. Anyway, everything's been made right. I'd been told that if I could ever go 10 years without infection, I'd be a candidate for a prosthetic hip. And I couldn't go a year. I couldn't work because if I try to work or try to play golf, the ooh would come guzzing out of me again, you know, the goo would come oozing out of me again. And I constantly had this chronic state of staph infection, and I'd lived with it forever. 10 years sober, I'm 10 years without infection. Go figure. And a very courageous doctor. A very courageous doctor did a lot of surgeries on me and made me whole. And today, for 28 years, I couldn't touch my left foot. For 28 years, I had a fused hip and a fused ankle. For 28 years, my left leg was 4 inches shorter than my right. For 28 years, I couldn't sit in the back of a car. I couldn't sit on a conventional toilet. For 28 years, I couldn't sit up to a table. For 28 years, I lived with chronic daily pain. And today, I live pain-free. And I can sit down here just like you guys. And I can put my elbows on my knees. I just love going to the toilet. I can take my own shoe off and on. I can cut my own toenails, but I haven't told my wife yet, so don't cheer. Next time you're taking a dump, I want you to think about me. Because for 28 years, it was bombs away for me, you know? I just straddle a hole and hope. My life is joyful. I can't imagine that any more could happen, but it has. That's the first 7 years of my sobriety. 2 years later, Kenny came to Dallas to tell me thank you. Then he went to my home and told my father on his deathbed, thank you for having a son like me. Then he went to my home group in Oklahoma City and told them thank you for getting me sober so that I could get him sober. And it just keeps getting better. It just keeps getting better. You all don't want to hear all the better. It's been too long. And I appreciate you all letting me share. I hope that your God loves you. I know he does. That he loves you as much as he loves me. I believe that God loves me because he's God, not because I'm good. There's not anything you have to do to avail yourself to his power except ask for help. Thank you. Thank you.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.